Welcome to The Point. I'm Mindy Todd. Today we sit down with three local authors. Later in the hour, Stephanie Seals talks about her children's book, My Daddy is a Cowboy, and we visit with Kate Pfeiffer to discuss her first novel for adults. But first, what would it be like to live like Gandhi? Perry Garfinkel's the author of Becoming Gandhi, My Experiment Living the Mahatma's Six Moral Truths in Immoral Times. Good to see you, Perry. Welcome.
Great to see you again.
All right, so this idea for your experiment first came to you when Barack Obama began his campaign for U.S. president in 2007. So explain that to us, because we're all into, you know, self-improvement, but becoming Gandhi, that's kind of a really big task. So tell us where this idea came from.
Well, originally, you know, I had written a book about Buddhism called Buddha or Bust, and I was a guest on your show probably 14 years ago. It was my literary agent who planted the seed of an idea. Why don't you follow that up with Gandhi? And I thought about it, and I had been to India many times and have seen images of Gandhi all over the place. And we read about him in social studies. But when Barack Obama was running for president with a campaign theme that echoed one of Gandhi's most famous lines, which is, be the change you want to see in the world. And I thought, wow, I bet a lot of people don't know who he's talking about because Obama credited Gandhi more than Martin Luther King Jr. as being a role model for how to achieve goals in the political arena. Gandhi was famous for his nonviolent protests against England in the early 1900s. Culminating in the independence of India in 1947. So I read more about Gandhi, and I realized there's a lot of principles that he followed and that he prescribed that could be a better moral compass for us in this world today. And when I looked around at myself, I had hit a kind of moral low at about several years later. And I saw the country moving in a direction that had lost faith in faith and lost its moral compass. So I thought it was time to really look at Gandhi, look at myself and the world through the prism of Mahatma Gandhi.
Yeah. So what did you see as the goal of your experiment? Because it's not to become the next Gandhi. While you do talk about Gandhi in the book, it's not a book about Gandhi. It's really more about your journey.
Thank you for saying that. Yes, because when I first talked to friends about it, especially Indian friends, they said, who are you, a white guy from America, to want to write about Gandhi? And I kept saying, it's not about Gandhi, but it's using Gandhi's principles to look in the mirror and look at myself. And that's where I thought my opportunity in the whole, you know, world of literature to make my mark. There are many books about Gandhi. I was at a Gandhi library in Mumbai. There's 400 books either by or about him. He read voraciously. He wrote even more voraciously. And so in my inimitable way, I thought, well, what can I do to be the change, literally? And so that's where it sort of took off. One more thing to say, it was a crazy beginning, crazy journey. When we talk about it, I'll tell you where I went and what I did. But when I took it on, the title was Being Gandhi. And very shortly into this experiment, I realized there's no way to be Gandhi. He was an amazing man. He was up at 3 a.m, was up until late at night. And so I realized maybe it's just the act of trying to become Gandhi, which I saw as an infinity pool. Like there was no end to the pool. There was no achieving Gandhihood. Mm-hmm. There's only the trying. Yeah. And in trying, there's success.
Yeah. I'm going to pick out some things in the book because obviously we can't cover everything. But you write, Gandhi put it this way, carefully watch your thoughts for they become your words. Manage and watch your words for they will become your actions. Consider and judge your actions for they have become your habits. Acknowledge and watch your habits for they shall become your values. Understand and embrace your values for they become your destiny. Wow.
Wow. How do you do that?
Yeah.
And in a lot of ways, he echoed what I had read about Buddhism and the Buddha. Be a light unto yourself was supposed to be the last words of the Buddha. So I took Gandhi's advice there and just tried these principles day after day, off and on, falling off the cushion, getting back on the cushion. If you should we take
Yeah,
maybe I should
I would
mention
say
this.
I wanted to say, why was it important for you to visit places that Gandhi lived and trace his actions, like the Salt March Trail? You sort of went to all of these places. Why was that important for this journey?
Thank you. For two reasons. One, I am an experiential journalist, so I like to, see it. I like to smell it. I like to feel it. So I wanted to go to the places where he was born, where he traveled, where he studied law, where he began to implement these changes to himself and socially, thinking that I could imbibe more of Gandhi that way. And the other thing, Mindy, that I wanted to do was do a kind of compare and contrast. Did Gandhi's imprint change the world? Did he leave an imprint? So in these places I went, Gujarat, the state where he grew up and was born and grew up, United Kingdom, in London specifically, where he studied law, and the 20 or so years he spent in South Africa in his beginning of his career as a lawyer, to see if people had implemented the changes that he was promoting. And in many cases, I felt it was not the case.
Yeah. And it's hard to really follow a lot of what, like, he walked a lot, as we know, something you emulated. But one fact you point out in the book that I found really interesting, scientists from the University of Sydney and the University of Southern Denmark found that walking 10,000 steps a day lowers the risk of dementia by about 50%, the risk of cancer by about 30%, and the risk of cardiovascular disease by about 75%. Still, you weren't looking at this as some sort of competition to achieve what Gandhi did as far as walking, but you also couldn't really take some of the same paths he took because the landscape has changed.
Right. He was famous for the Salt March, which was a 230-mile march from the city he had his first ashram in, Ahmedabad, Gujarat, to the sea, a beach called Dandi, to protest the use of salt, to protest the sale of salt back to the Indians when they could lift it from the ocean. It turned out I was going to reenact that. I started out the first 5 miles. I almost got killed on superhighways, and they were small roads when he started. But again, Mindy, metaphorically, I took this as a, excuse the pun, marching orders to do it myself. So when I came back to the U.S., I had, I used to work for Rodale Press, which was famous for taking little scientific factoids and suggesting how to integrate them into your lives. And I read studies that show that 20 minutes of walking was, if at a minimum, okay, good enough to help you lower your heart rate, improve your pulse, et cetera, et cetera. So Gandhi was said to walk 10 miles a day. I started out trying to walk 10. I got up to 5 and 7 a few times. And then, in our busy American and modern lives, everywhere, it's hard to spend almost 2 hours walking. So I walk now a minimum of 3 miles a day. And it amazes me because it's become a kind of religion for me. I eschew a lot of things. I don't floss every day, but I do walk every day. And here where I am on Martha's Vineyard, I have certain trails I've walked for years, and I'm back here for a visit, actually. And I've gone over those trails again, and I feel walking is a meditation, and it's fresh air, and it's all those things that those studies you cited speak to.
You had an interesting visit with Gandhi's great grandson, who you say is as un-Gandhi-like as one could imagine.
That's Tushar Gandhi. He's a real rebel without a cause, but his cause is the same as his great grandfather's, to just shake the tree and see if people wake up a little bit. He ran for a political position. He did not get elected, but he still is a one-man band, shouting a foul wherever he can find it.
We hear the word truth, and what comes to mind, one truth, but like we think there's just one truth. Truth is truth, right? But there are many kinds of truth that I never really thought of until you point them out in the book. Absolute truth, ultimate truth, relative truth, contingent truth, and objective, normative, subjective, complex truth. I mean, wow. It's like make what is truth?
True. Yeah, it also daunted me. Well, what are we talking about? Because we can start from the lowest, tell the truth, don't lie. And in my book, I do this kind of confessional where I share everything I lie about. What Gandhi also famously said, God is truth. He was a deeply spiritual man. So he first, when he was first studying this, he decided God is truth. And then as he thought more and deeper into what is absolute truth and ultimate truth, he realized truth is God. Like if you can follow the truth, I think he was saying, there you will get to God. If you tell the truth, that's the baseline. But I took it deeper with all of these, Mindy. And I said, well, what is my truth? And I realize I lie to myself all the time. And I realize waking up every morning, we all put on this personality, the one we are at work or the one we are as a couple, to your parents and to your children. And it's a persona, it's an ego. And is that true? Because I know you say something, but four other thoughts are in your mind of, oh yeah, but he's an idiot. I don't like this person, but you don't share those truths. So it really came down to, for me, to look in the mirror and ask myself and ask our readers, what is your truth? Meaning, who are you at the end of the day? If you took off all your metaphorical clothes and you were just stripped down to your bare naked truth, who are you and what is your purpose? And in fact, my next book revolves around the idea of purpose, since it's come up a lot now in the zeitgeist, like live a life of purpose.
Yeah,
And
that was the next thing I was going to talk about is that complex subject of tackle of purpose, something, many people wonder, what is my purpose? And the answer can change over one's lifetime, right? You think you know what your purpose is, but then maybe it's not, it's something else. And you sort of note that purpose doesn't come in one aha.
that's right. And also, and this sort of circles back to truth, the truth changes from every moment to the next moment. Truth is ephemeral and it's also flexible. Purpose, I think, is a little more consistent. I myself, when I look back at my life, I wrote, this is funny, Mindy, I haven't thought of this. In second grade, I wrote a little essay that I got. Remember we used to get those little stickers at the top of our papers with a turkey or some kind of animal or star. I wrote a little essay in second grade, and my teacher pulled my parents aside and they said, nurture that in him. And through high school and even in college, I never thought of a career in journalism as an author. Years later, probably when I was about 30, and I wrote my first book, I realized, oh, this was, ordained. This was a karma for me since an early age, and I realized that's my purpose. Some of us have the luck of that I had. Others change their purpose from day to day, and I think that's okay too.
Yeah. Gandhi did not have many material possessions. And you talk about all the stuff we collect and the fact that we also dump a lot of stuff. The average American consumer produces up to 5 pounds of trash a day. I kind of feel like in our younger years, we collect stuff, more and more stuff. And then as you get to a certain age, I'm one of those that doesn't like to let go of my stuff. But in the last few years, I'm like, all right, I'm 68 years old. What am I going to do with all this stuff, right? And you start to clean out your stuff. But it is, I mean, that's another area I think that's difficult for people is to kind of let go of the material possessions.
Yes. And I think as you mentioned, when you're younger, you collect stuff. I think it's in lieu of being stuff. We're sort of in the age of defining ourselves and building a career, building a family. So the things you surround yourself are part of your def self-definition. As we get older, we can shed those stuffs because we come more into ourselves. And I, for this chapter I wrote about simplicity, I went through my closet and literally cleaned out my closet, and I gave away a shirt that I hadn't worn for 20 years, and lots of stuff. And I brought it to Goodwill and recycling centers, and I felt unburdened in a way that really I felt cleansed. And I kind of followed that with many other things. For instance, I use the internet yet less, social media less, and I also called a moratorium on acquiring anything new that was not necessary. And that was in a gesture of simplicity. Gandhi, since you brought it up, he died with about eight objects. And I comment in my book that most people will judge a man by how much he had accumulated in his life, he or she. And in Gandhi's case, it was telling that he had basically accumulated less and less because he became more and more.
You also talk about diet, and this, Gandhi had a lot to say on that, and that's an area that a lot of people struggle. What is the best diet? Is it vegetarian? Is it vegan? Is it, what is it, right?
Yes, he was a vegetarian. And he was vegetarian religiously because his mother was a devout Vaishnavas, which is a sect of Hinduism. When he went to England and he joined the Vegetarian Society of London, and he became a treasurer. And it was there in his early 20s that he really read up on what is more common now, that meat causes heart attacks, that too much salt gives you diabetes, et cetera, et cetera. So he became a vegetarian. I tried vegetarianism for about a year or so. And to say I came from a meat and potatoes family was like a right, that was like a boast. Oh yeah, I'm a meat and potatoes guy. And dad made the best steak and mom made the best meatloaf and a killer corned beef. But I became, and now I'm a pescatarian and I'm very happy with that. I love fish. That's why I love this island and all of the Cape area. But fish sort of sustains me. And there's, if I was truly deeply Buddhist, I would not be eating fish either because it would be killing things. But what I feel is, I should say this, in all of the advice I give, I found the word tapering is valuable asset. To go cold turkey on these six principles.
Impossible, yeah.
Yeah. But to taper down, it's easy to drop one meat meal a day or a week.
Yeah.
Mindy, let me say the six principles that I
Sure,
did
go ahead.
follow up. So truth, he's most known for truth and nonviolence. The others are simplicity, faith, vegetarianism, and celibacy. And so I practiced all of these in some way or another every day, no matter what I was doing. It was on my in my mental Rolodex, if you will. Have I, done something to be more simple today, et cetera, et cetera. Each of them have its own chapter in my book, and each chapter is a life.
I thought it was interesting because religion, of course, we think about causes a lot of wars, right? And when it comes to religion, you call yourself, I thought this was interesting, a Hindu Jew.
Yes, you could also call me, I call myself a spiritual expeditionary. I've experimented and tried on many religions. I was born Jewish. I was bar mitzvahed, where my family is very culturally Jewish. And then in my 20s, when I first went to India and was a student of Ram Dass, the great American Jewish Buddhist Hindu teacher, I was more Hindu. And then after my first trip to India, and when I came back, I studied Buddhism and eventually wrote that book, Buddha or Bust. But I feel if you asked me to choose a religion, I would not. I could not. I would say Buddhism is closest to what I would practice. But I remember when my last book came out, I gave a talk at the Unitarian Universalist Church here in Martha's Vineyard and Vineyard Haven. And as soon as I walked in, I said to myself, this is home. You see the icons of all of the religions. And that's what universalist means to me, embracing, whereas other religions are exclusive.
Where are you in your journey now?
Well, I'm still, becoming Gandhi. These things in the mental Rolodex keep swirling around. I still walk at least 3 miles a day. I'm still a pescatarian. I am try to maintain a simple lifestyle. Often I call myself a simple guy who was born into a complex life because as a journalist, interviewing people around the world, you're pulled into these situations that make you kind of multitask in the brain. It like hurts my brain sometimes. To kind of juggle everything I know and all the people I know and cull them down to my own essential becoming Perry. Maybe that'll be my next book.
Becoming Gandhi is, like I said, pretty tall order. So I'm just going to take from what you just said. Your advice really is to tackle this in small doses. Tackle what you can achieve. In other words, set achievable goals, right? I mean, that's the message.
Yes, achievable goals, and don't give up. You're gonna mess up. There's the old Zen saying, fall off the meditation cushion 9 times, get back on it the 10th. So I think the awareness that there is this kind of philosophy that Mahatma Gandhi represented, that you can take it yourself and turn it, twist it your own way. To make it work for you, but work on it.
The book is Becoming Gandhi, My Experiment, Living in the Mahatma's Six Moral Truths in Immoral Times. Perry Garfinkel is the author. We'll have a link with more information at our website, capeandislands.org. Perry, thanks so much for joining us. It was an interesting read. I really appreciate it.
Thank you very much for this very attentive read, and always fun to be with you.
Coming up after break, a humorous exploration of the creative process. You're listening to The Point. Kate Pfeiffer has a new book out. It's titled Morning Pages. Hi, Kate.
Hi, Mindy.
So your previous books, I said people know you more as an illustrator and your previous books have been for children. This is your first adult novel. So tell us what led you down this path.
Well, the novel is in a lot of ways what they call autofiction. And what led me down this path was I'd written 11 books for children and had some success with them and suddenly was unable to get a book published. And
what?
Yeah, I agree with that assessment. What? But I kept writing them and just was, some people say it's the hardest part is getting in the door. And for me, the hardest part was getting in the door for the 12th time. So I was inspired to write a book about someone who is a creative, trying to make a career out of creative work, and had some early success. And then her career sort of fell off a cliff. And so the main character, Morning Pages, which is written using the device of Morning Pages, which is a playwright. And she was very successful early in her career, sort of heralded as a playwright to watch, a young playwright to watch. And since she turned 40, was unable to get a play produced. And in that time, after very, happy young days, also her marriage has fallen apart. Her son is a teenager and quite sullen. So.
Yeah, a lot going on. And you mentioned Morning Pages. So our main character, Elise, starts scribbling a few pages of it's like streaming of consciousness, right? Not really a journal. She does this every morning as a way to get over her writer's block. And this is a technique called Morning Pages, popularized in Julia Cameron's book, The Artist's Way. So this was an intentional thing. You had that in your mind when you came up with the title Morning Pages, this was the technique you were going to use, right?
Exactly. Yes. Yeah. And I came to Morning Pages when I moved to the Vineyard and joined my first writers group. Mm-hmm. And we started doing Morning Pages together. And I thought this would be an interesting technique to use to tell the story of this blocked playwright. She has 65 days to finish her play, and the story unfolds in the 65 days of her Morning Pages.
Right. So talk about the format of the book, because it's Elise's thought, but it's also marked up scenes from her play, right? So a play within a novel. Where did that come from?
So because I was writing a book about a playwright, I decided that I should write a play to understand really how a play, you know, if this is a book about process in a lot of ways, I should be familiar with that process. So I took playwriting class. I read a lot of plays, which are great to read. I mean, you think of plays as something you go to a theater to experience, but in fact, reading a play, as you might read a novel, they're entertaining, they're fabulous to read on the paper. So I wrote this play not intentionally to be as part of the book, but as an exercise in writing about a playwright. And I wrote the play not that I wanted to write necessarily, but I wrote a play that I thought my main character in the book would write. And then I thought, well, what if we insert a few of those scenes into the book? And so originally I had a few of the scenes into the book. And then during the editing process, once the book was sold, I started inserting more and more of the play. And then we decided, well, let's just have scenes from the play throughout the book and make it a story within a story. So the book itself is both a novel and a play. But I also wanted, because it is a lot about process and writing, to have her marked up scribbles and notations to herself about the play. Yeah. So those are within the play.
And as you say, it is a lot about process. And I think that's appealing to a lot of would-be writers, right? It's like, oh, this is because everybody, and even people who aren't wanting to be writers, everybody always wants to know about process, right? What's your process? That's a question every author gets asked all the time. And you just put it all out there. So this is quite a cast of characters, along with Elise. We mentioned we have her teenage sort of stoner son, her overbearing, eccentric mother, her best friend. Are these based on real people? Where do these characters come from?
It's a mix.
A mix. Okay.
It's a mix. So her mother, Trudy, who is very much based on my mother. And my mother was glamorous. She was brilliant. She had a raging temper and serious boundary issues. Like she liked
sounds
to-
like, Sounds ask, like Trudy, yeah.
Sounds like Trudy. You know, I would bring friends home and she would ask them, you know, about their sex lives long before they even had sex lives. So it was always like this, oh no, what's she doing moments. And I started writing this book a while ago, but I started writing it not really as a book, but just chronicling what was the early stages of my mother's dementia. Mm-hmm. And this time in life when you're not sure, like if someone's eccentric and suddenly starts being eccentric and erratic, you're trying to figure out what's going on. Right. And so I was interested in that. So the character of Trudy, the mother, is very much based on and inspired by my mother. Marsden, her son, is not at all. I have one daughter, and Marsden is entirely created. At one point, I had Marsden as a girl, and I thought, if I write her like my daughter, I'll get in trouble. If I write her not like my daughter, everyone will think she's like my daughter, and I'll still get in trouble. So let me create a son who's entirely has his own personality.
Yeah, so true, because people read and they go, is that me, right? with the character's book. Talk about Elise's best friend.
Maya. So as someone who really values my friends, I know the importance of having that type of female friendship where you talk about everything. You take long walks, you process on walks. There's a lot of walking in the book where they process things. And Maya is someone who also is completely created, because I didn't want to pull from someone I knew. So she's not even amalgamation. She is just invented. And she's someone who's got her stuff together. She's professionally very successful. She does PR. She's the type of, she's brilliant. She remembers everyone, not only your name, but the dog, your dog's name, your cat's name, your birthday, your dog's birthday. She has one of those brains where things stick, and she's compassionate and pushy and has a secret.
Yeah, the friend everybody would like to have, right? And sometimes, I mean, Maya means well, but I'm just thinking, it's kind of like, here's Elise, you know, her marriage is broken up, and everybody wants to fix you up with somebody, and you know, well-meaning, but that can add to a lot of the pressure in your life, right?
Right.
Yeah.
So Maya's the one who said, look, you need to do Morning Pages. You need to finish this play. You should try Morning Pages. But Maya also has suggested, like, you know, drinking smoothies. And Elise is 2 years divorced, and Maya's encouraging her to lose her so-called divorce
Yeah.
virginity to help her over a writer's block. So.
Yeah. Was this experience obviously a lot different than writing for children, right? Talk about that experience for you. I know you belong to writers' groups and things, but what was that experience? Because very different, a very different kind of mindset when you're writing a novel for adults, right?
Very different. So for this novel, it was very, my writers groups were, I have a writers group on the Vineyard. And then when my daughter went off to school, started spending a little bit more time in New York in the winter and joined a writers group or created a writers group in the city. And this book, unlike my children's books, which I wrote by myself and then workshopped on my daughter or her friends, this book was really workshopped in my writers groups. And it would not in any way exist without these incredible writers groups. It's dedicated to my writers groups, but their feedback was always spot on. Their laughter, because it's a funny novel. So when I would read the scenes and hear the laughter, you know, I felt like I wanted to write a comic novel. They're laughing. This is working. So the process was first of all much, much longer than writing a children's book, but also the feedback, it was very feedback driven for me. I did not just sit down and at my computer and bang this out and then hand it off. It was done in bits and pieces, and there was feedback given on every bit and piece in this book.
Yeah, I'm just sort of chuckling to myself when we say comic novel, because we think about this. Here's Elise, dubbed the playwright to watch, and then she's kind of forgotten. So this new play that she's doing, Déjà-nous, is really important. That's a lot of pressure. And sometimes that pressure can contribute to writer's block. So she's got writer's block. She's got this overbearing mother with dementia. She's got, you know, the moody teenager, the husband. So she's still kind of pining a little bit for. This is like a lot of, it can sound so depressing, right? This is like everybody's midlife crisis, but there are so many laugh out loud moments. And I'm just thinking about how you take those things that can be so depressing and make them funny. That's a gift to be able to do
Thank
that.
you.
Yeah.
Thank
So
you.
is that just how you think in real life? I mean, how that sense of
That's
humor?
how I process things. That's how I sort of get through my day, the hard stuff. And I mean, it doesn't always, you can't always process tragedy, but
Right.
the absurdity of the hard stuff, I process through finding the funny moments of the humor in it. And yeah, so that's sort of the way I process anyway. So I gave her that, and but I also wanted to write something because these, you know, it's I call the book like a coming of age story for the sandwich generation,
Yeah.
and it's being, you know, which is when you're being pulled in both directions, or multiple directions. You're being pulled by your kids. You're being pulled by your aging parents. You're being pulled by your own ambitions and desires, and you know, there's you're just basically being pulled apart. And I mean, you could read a novel about that and just feel devastated, but I wanted to write something light and that you know, funny and engaging, but also so people who are going through all this like feel seen
Yeah.
and
It's relatable. Yeah, it's very relatable for sure. And you gave yourself that the 65 days is her deadline. And so you're, in a sense, on this deadline with her. Did you feel that when you were writing the book?
No, this book took me forever.
It took a lot longer than 65 years.
65 years.
All right, let's talk a little bit too. She's still got some feelings for her ex-husband, and everybody's trying to fix her up with everybody, but there is this handsome stranger in the elevator. What do we want to say about him?
So when she goes, her mother, Elise lives in Dedham, Massachusetts. Her mother lives in New York City, where I grew up. And when she goes to visit her mother, who lives on the 15th floor, there's a handsome man who lives on the 16th floor that she often finds herself in the elevator with. And they seem to be having, Elise believes, this very intense elevator flirtation. And while she's been set up on these dates and nothing has clicked, she has a raving crush on this man in the elevator. And
we'll see what happens.
We'll see what happens.
So, you know, you've got all these really interesting characters in the book. And I often wonder, I mean, writers are always talking about how they start out and somebody has maybe a little bit part in the story, and but they won't be quiet, right? They just make their presence known and they become a much bigger player in the story. Did that happen for you in this book?
I think the character, the son, Marsden, he was, the book really started as an exploration of Elise and her mother. And then Marsden came to life more and more as her son, even though he doesn't speak. He does speak, but in, you know, using one syllable. So he's stoned, he's monosyllabic, but he's someone who sort of grew throughout the book. And Maya also, there were a few characters that I added in also that I felt I needed more, like the character of Sammy Ronstein, who is the producer and the artistic director of the theater. He's a bit character, but he's someone who wasn't in the early draft. And then I felt like I needed to bring in a character like him to add a different level of professional dimension to it.
Yeah. So what is it that you hope readers take away from the book?
I hope readers will, like I said before, be seen. I hope they will be entertained. I hope they will relate to it. And I hope they'll have some fun with it. Mm-hmm.
So now that you've had this experience of writing an adult novel, is it something you plan to pursue? What are your thoughts going forward?
I have an idea for another adult novel that I've not started. I'm working on another children's book. And then I have an idea that I'm going to work for a proposal for this summer that involves both illustration and writing. Mm-hmm. And it's entirely different. But
any thoughts in there about writing a play?
And now that you've had this actually experience. Well, the play was, out of all of this, like the novel and the play I wrote the fastest. The play was a lot of fun and came really quickly. So
maybe. All doors are open.
All doors are open. We are the play. We're doing a reading at the play at the Vineyard Playhouse this summer at the end of July. So the play is a full play in itself. And we had a reading just for my ears in New York, because I wasn't sure if I had written a novel with a play in it or a novel and a play. Mm-hmm. So we, the Barrow Group, which is this wonderful theater company in New York, did a reading. And it appears that I've written a novel and a play. So we're going to do a reading at the Playhouse at the end of July, and then hopefully that will have more, something will become of that. We'll see.
The book is Morning Pages, a novel by Kate Pfeiffer, and we'll have a link with more information of the book at our website, capeandislands.org. Kate, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you, Mindy. It's wonderful to be here with you.
Coming up after a break, Stephanie Seals with a children's book on urban cowboys. You're listening to The Point. My Daddy is a Cowboy is a new children's book which celebrates Black joy and the relationship between child and parent. The book is illustrated by C.G. Esperanza and written by Stephanie Seals. Stephanie, welcome to the program and congratulations on the book.
Hi, Mindy. Thanks for having me and thank you.
You've worked in many aspects of book business, including as a former children's librarian here on the Cape. How did your previous experiences and work lead you to this moment of having a children's book published?
That's a great question. And I think the answer is all of my experience in the children's book industry in libraries and bookstores, in schools, and a little bit in a publishing house have been really helpful at this point in my career transitioning to the author side, because I understand how things work in all of those different aspects. So it gives me a very holistic view of the industry and helps me to connect with people about my book, because I know different ways that it might be relevant to them from my experience.
Now, cowboys are typically found in rural communities, but the cowboys in your book are concrete cowboys, riders in urban areas. Are there concrete cowboys in metropolitan areas like Philadelphia and Chicago? Tell us more about these horsemen and women and how you came to center your story on them.
I'd love to. So the book was inspired by the Compton Cowboys, which are exactly what they sound like. They're cowboys in Compton, which is a city in Southern California. And I'm from Southern California. So when I found out about them, which was a couple years before I wrote the book, I was really interested because I also didn't know about urban cowboys. And so I've been following them on social media when a friend sent me an article about them in 2020 and asked if I had ever thought of writing a book about them. And I hadn't, but then I did. And then I wrote the book. And since then, I found out that there are urban cowboys all over the states. As you say, like Philadelphia, even in New York City, lots of places. I think it's much more common than we would think. And I'm excited to shine a light on the culture.
Yeah. Now, your story starts in the pre-dawn, and it's a special moment. One, because the protagonist is doing something special with her father. And the two, because she's it's still dark, up before everyone else in the community, just through the setting and the illustrations, which we're going to get to in a minute, you've created this sense of excitement and anticipation. Talk about this part of the story.
So I really wanted a story that centered Black joy, and I wanted it to be sort of what we call in the industry like an everyday story. I wanted it to be something that's special, but within the context of like an everyday situation. So I wanted to start the story in their home with her like waking up so that you get the full experience of them being able to like get ready, leave the house, go out to the ranch, then go further out into their community and eventually circle back and come home. So you have a full circle moment there. I don't know if that answered
you. No, it does. I want to get to the illustrations. The illustrations in this book are, I mean, gorgeous is an understatement. I looked at it and I went, wow. Particularly the ones in the pre-dawn, which show the variation in color of night and pre-dawn. Talk about your collaboration with the illustrator.
Sure. So C.G. Esperanza is the illustrator, and he's an amazing artist, as you know.
Absolutely.
You've seen the book.
Oh, my goodness.
Just like really incredible. He works in oils as well, if you can believe it. It's like so amazing. So the way it generally works with books is your publisher will choose the illustrator for your book. If you're a picture book author like me, authors don't always have a say. Thankfully, I have a wonderful editor, Courtney Claude at Abrams, who we were in very much in collaboration about who the right illustrator was. And working with CG, one of the things that drew me to him was his sense of like whimsy, in addition to his amazing color palette and the way that he portrays faces and expressions. So specifically talking to like those pre-dawn sort of spreads that you're talking about, I love what he did with the sort of like cool shapes that you see in the sky and stuff. And it's like, it gives a sense of magic to it that I really wanted, even though this is very much a story that's grounded in reality. I didn't want to lose that sort of almost fantastical feel, and he really did a great job of bringing that into the story.
Yeah, you really feel, you feel, you can see the light changing, right, as the story progresses. It's amazing. Now, you reveal a lot about this young protagonist throughout the story. We know that along with her parents and her grandmother lives with her, she rides regularly. She knows her way around horses and how to care for them, and she feels at home in her community. Tell us a little bit more about this character and how she took shape in your mind.
These are such great questions, and it's great to cast my mind back to that time. So it's been like 4 years now since I wrote the manuscript. One thing that was important to me is my family is from Panama. Both of my parents are immigrants. And so I wanted to portray culturally a Panamanian American family. So that was a piece. For the girl herself, I think, if I'm remembering correctly, that I was thinking about more like showing her excitement and someone who's having this really special experience and how I could portray like this really vibrant and loving family. That was really important to me. And I, grandmas are very important to me. And that's part of why that character's in there, based on one of my own grandmas. And so I wanted to make sure that even though the bulk of the story is the protagonist and her dad, that the other members of the family were also in there in a way that shows that they're important in the family and important to her.
And I love it. It's like, it's the just us time between dad and daughter. But this is, I think, probably one of my favorite lines in the book. And it talks about dad telling stories as they're riding along. And she says, "I only interrupt 5 times to ask questions." So it's so cute.
I was that kid.
Yeah.
So.
On previous shows, we've discussed the lack of diversity in children's literature. Are you seeing more effort on the part of editors and publishers to include diverse stories and characters?
It's definitely, since the last time I was on the show, which I think was like maybe 6 years ago or 7 years ago, things have definitely improved. In some aspects, it's slow going. You know, there's still a lot of work to be done. But I think depending on what publisher you're talking about and which editors you're talking about, the push is definitely there. I see it a lot in Abrams, my publisher, just looking at the other books coming out this spring. You have a very diverse array of stories, and that makes me really happy.
In your view, what are the stories and faces still missing from children's literature?
I mean, I think that there's space for more stories, particularly for people from marginalized communities, like that. It's not like we've come to a place where there's enough for anyone. But personally, I would really like to see more stories that feature fat protagonists. We don't see a lot of that. And disabled protagonists, both visible and invisible, and various people of the Pacific Islands. Like, we don't really, if there are any books about the Pacific, and there are some now, there are more than there used to be, we mostly see Polynesia. We don't see like Micronesia or Melanesia, and I would like to see more of all.
So what advice do you have for others hoping to get their project to print?
I think the best place to start, if you're not well-versed in children's books, is reading a lot of books, like quality books. I really can't emphasize that enough. I feel like that is really what's made me the writer that I am, reading so much over so many years. And then, you know, just making sure that you're telling stories that are authentic, and that you have, for me, at least as important, a heart connection to. So I think that that will then resonate with readers as well as like agents and editors.
Stephanie Seals is the author of the new children's book, My Daddy is a Cowboy, which is illustrated by C.G. Esperanza. We'll post a link with more information about the book at our website, capeandislands.org. Stephanie, thanks so much for being with us and bringing us this beautiful book.
Thank you so much for having me, Mindy.
I'm Mindy Todd. Thanks for listening.